I want to start this deep dive with a question for you listening right now. A question that, usually only really comes up after maybe three or four drinks.
Oh, we are starting right in the deep end today.
We really are. So just look around the room you're in right now.
Right, look at the table, look at your phone.
Look at the walls. Is that the world as it actually exists? Or is that just a simulation created by your own mind?
It's the ultimate red pill
Yet
question.
it really is.
But long before anyone was talking about the Matrix, this was the exact question that basically woke philosophy up from a very long nap.
A dogmatic slumber, I believe the source material called it.
They did call it that, yeah. And the guy doing the waking up was Immanuel Kant.
Which brings us to our mission today. We are doing a deep dive into Kant's epistemology, specifically unpacking his critique of pure reason.
And I know right off the bat, that title,
It sounds like a cure for insomnia.
it sounds incredibly dense and dry. But based on the research we've pulled together, this book is actually the moment human consciousness decided to, well, pop the hood and look at its own engine.
Exactly. We're looking at epistemology today, which is just a fancy word for the theory of knowledge. How do we know what we know?
And Kant's answer to that is radically different from everything that came before him. He essentially argues that our minds are not passive mirrors, just reflecting the world outside.
Right, they're active filters.
Exactly. We are constantly manufacturing our own reality.
Which is, frankly, a terrifying thought if you dwell on it too long. It kind of implies we're trapped in our own heads.
It does feel a bit conspiratorial when you first grasp it.
But before we get to the whole existential crisis part of it, we really need to understand the machinery he's proposing.
Right, the setup. Kant breaks this whole thing down into two main sections that we're going to cover.
The transcendental aesthetic, which is all about sensing.
And the transcendental analytic, which is about understanding or thinking.
But where do we even begin with a system this massive and complex?
I think we have to start with the enemy, or at least the prevailing idea that Kant was fighting against at the time.
The blank slate myth.
Yes. The blank slate, John Locke and the empiricists.
Right. Because Locke believed that when we are born, the mind is a tabula rasa.
An empty cabinet or a blank piece of paper.
It
The idea was that the world happens to us, it stamps impressions onto us, and that is how we accumulate knowledge.
We are just passive receivers, which, makes total sense intuitively.
It feels right.
Yeah, I open my eyes, light hits my retinas, and I see a tree. I didn't actually do anything. The tree did all the work.
That is exactly how it feels to walk around the world. But Kant looks at that and says, no, that is actually impossible.
Why impossible?
Because if your mind were truly just a blank slate, the world wouldn't look like a neatly organized tree. It would look like a chaotic, terrifying mess of visual noise.
Okay, so he's arguing the mind has to be preformed in some way.
Right. It has to have a structure already in place to receive that incoming data.
The notes mention a specific analogy from the source here that I think is super helpful for visualizing this.
The violin case.
The violin case, yes, or the ice cube tray. Let's use the ice cube tray.
It's the perfect metaphor for this. So think about raw water. Water's fluid, it's formless, it just takes the shape of whatever container holds it.
Okay, so in this analogy, the raw water is the sensory input.
Exactly. The raw data of the world. The unorganized sights, the sounds, the smells pouring into you.
And my mind is the ice cube tray.
Yes. So by the time you actually consciously experience that water, it's already been frozen into cubes.
I never experience the water as it is in the pitcher.
Never. You only ever experience the cubes that your own mind created.
So we are actively contributing the shape. The world gives us the raw stuff, the water, but we provide the form.
That is the crucial shift. And Kant formalizes this into two faculties. He calls the first one sensibility or the aesthetic.
Which is the process of letting the water in.
Right. And the second is understanding or the analytic, which is what we do with those cubes once we have them.
And there is a really famous formula he uses to describe how these two things relate to each other.
Right. The dictum. Concepts without percepts are empty.
And percepts without concepts are blind. Let's break that down because it's a lot of terminology.
Sure. Let's start with the first half. Concepts without percepts are empty.
Well, a concept is just an abstract idea, right? Like a mental file folder.
Exactly. Let's say you have a file folder in your brain labeled dinosaur.
Okay, but if I never actually see a dinosaur or a bone or a picture of one, that folder just sits there empty.
Right. Pure thought, just having the category, can't give you actual knowledge of the physical world. You need sensory input to fill the folder.
So concepts without percepts are empty. That makes sense. But the second half is where Kant really flips things around.
Percepts without concepts are blind.
This one is trickier. A percept is a raw sensory hit, right? Like a flash of light or a sudden noise.
Let's put you in a scenario. Imagine you're walking down a really dark alley at night.
Okay, I'm already on edge.
And suddenly, you see a shape up ahead. It's just a blob of gray and black. Your heart rate spikes.
Because I don't know what it is yet. Is it a guy waiting to mug me? Is it a stray dog?
Exactly. You're getting the raw percept, the visual data, but you don't have a concept to attach to it yet.
And until my brain snaps the label trash can onto it, I'm just staring at meaningless visual noise.
A visual noise is blind. It doesn't mean anything to you as a conscious observer. You absolutely need the concept, the trash can category, to organize that raw data into an object you can actually understand and interact with.
So human knowledge is essentially a collision of these two things.
It's the water hitting the tray. Without the raw water, you have absolutely nothing to freeze.
And without the structured tray, you just have a puddle on the counter.
Exactly. That is the core of Kant's transcendental idealism.
To give some flavor of how precise Kant was being with this system, the source actually highlights a few specific German terms he used.
Oh, right. The terminology. It really shows how he was basically building an engineering schematic for the brain.
Yeah, he uses the word Anschauung, which translates roughly to intuition or sensory awareness.
That's the percept part, the raw data.
Right. And then Verstand is the faculty of understanding.
And Begriff is the concept itself, the file folder.
It's all very systematic, but it does raise a question. Why do we need this massive, complex machinery just to see a trash can?
It feels like over-engineering, doesn't it?
It really does. Why couldn't he just stick with John Locke and say, hey, I see a trash can because there's a trash can there?
The short answer is David Hume.
The Scottish philosopher.
Right. Hume was a radical skeptic, and he was the guy who famously kept count up at night. Hume argued that if you really, truly analyze your sensory experience, it is completely disjointed.
Disjointed how?
He called it atomistic.
Atomistic. Like our experience is just made up of little disconnected dots.
Yes. Think about a really simple sequence. Let's use the beep example from the source material. Imagine hearing a machine go beep, beep, beep.
Okay. Three distinct sounds.
Physiologically speaking, what just happened in the physical world?
Well, a sound wave hit my eardrum. It vibrated and then it stopped. And then it did it again.
Right. Vibrated, stopped. Vibrated, stopped. Three completely separate, distinct physical events.
Atom A, atom B, atom C.
Exactly. But psychologically, inside your mind, what did you actually hear?
I heard a pattern. I heard a rhythm.
You heard a sequence. But where does that sequence actually exist? It is not in the air.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because the first beep is literally gone, physically gone, before the second one even starts.
They never exist at the same time in the physical universe.
So the connection, the rhythm itself, implies that I am actively holding on to the past beep and stitching it to the present beep.
You are the glue. The cohesion doesn't come from the physical airwaves. It comes entirely from your internal synthesizer.
So Hume says, look, I only see distinct separate events. And Kant says, yes, physically that's true, but I experience a unified reality. Therefore, my mind must be doing the unifying.
He takes the booming, buzzing confusion of the world, all those sights and smells and sizzling sounds, and unifies them into a single coherent experience, like eating a meal.
It's like the difference between a flip book and a movie.
That's a great way to think about it.
The physical world is just providing these separate static pages, but my mind is thumbing through them fast enough to make it look like continuous motion.
And Kant calls that active process synthesis, which brings us to the first massive filter in our mental ice cube tray.
The transcendental aesthetic.
Yes.
Which honestly is a deeply confusing name, because when I hear aesthetic, I think of art. Or beauty, or interior design.
Yeah, we use it very differently today. He's relying on the ancient Greek root of the word aesthesis, which just refers to sensation or perception.
So this is the hardware for sensing.
Exactly. This is where he drops the absolute bombshell about space and time.
This was the part of the reading where I legitimately had to set my coffee down and just stare at the wall for a minute.
It breaks your brain a little bit the first time you grasp it.
Because normally, casually, we think of space and time as the objective container that the universe comes in.
Right. Like there is a giant infinite cardboard box called space, and we're all just floating around inside of it.
And that was Isaac Newton's view, right?
Yes. Newtonian physics relied on that. Newton thought space and time were absolute objective realities. God built the box, and then he put the stars and planets inside the box.
But Kant comes along and completely inverts that.
He says no. Space and time are not things that exist out there in the world. They are subjective forms of sensibility. They are the way we process things in here, in our minds.
So if I'm tracking this, you're saying space is basically mental software.
It is the interface. It's the grid that your mind projects onto the raw, blind data to make it readable to you.
Hold on. Let's play this out. If that is true, does that mean if all conscious humans just vanish tomorrow, space and time would disappear too?
According to Kant's strict system, yes.
That seems completely absurd. The stars would still be physically apart from each other, wouldn't they? The planets would still orbit the sun.
But think about the words you're using. Apart is a spatial concept. Orbit implies a duration in time. Kant argues that you physically cannot even imagine an object without putting space around it.
Let me try.
Try to picture a physical object that is not situated somewhere in space.
I can't do it. It has to be somewhere.
Exactly. Your mind won't let you do it. But conversely, you can easily imagine empty space without any objects in it.
Sure, just a black void.
That asymmetry proves, for Kant, that space is a feature built into the viewer, not a property of the object itself.
We bring the here and the there.
And the before and the after. We are all essentially born wearing space-time glasses that are permanently glued to our faces.
We can never take them off to see what the world actually looks like naked.
Never. We only ever see the world through the lens of space and time.
And the source notes explain that this was actually Kant's solution to a huge puzzle regarding math and geometry.
Yes, this is a massive implication of his theory. People had always wondered why geometry describes the physical world so flawlessly.
Like, how can we sit in a room and logically prove that the internal angles of a triangle will always add up to 180 degrees?
Even in a galaxy we haven't visited yet, or a billion years in the future.
Right. I always just assumed it's because the universe itself is fundamentally made of math.
That's the standard view. But Kant says, no, that's backwards. Geometry is the formal science of space. And since space is actually the structure of the human mind...
Oh, wow. Geometry is actually just mapping the human mind.
Yes. We aren't mapping the outer universe. A perfect circle or a perfectly straight line doesn't actually exist as a physical object out in the mud and the dirt.
It exists as a mental ideal. We are just mapping the contours of our own internal violin case.
We know the triangle will always fit perfectly because our minds literally manufacture the mold that the triangle falls into.
That is incredibly arrogant, deeply human-centric, and yet weirdly convincing all at the same time.
It's a complete paradigm shift.
Okay, so we've got the raw data coming in, and it's being filtered through our space-time glasses. That covers the sensing part, the aesthetic.
Right. But seeing things in space and time isn't enough. We still have to think about them.
Which brings us to the second stage of the factory, the transcendental analytic.
This is the med of the mind. Now that the data is organized into space and time, we have to apply categories to it to actually generate understanding.
And these categories are basically the fundamental concepts we use to build thoughts.
Exactly. Kant outlines 12 of them, categorized into things like substance and quantity.
Mm-hmm.
But the big one, the one that really anchors this whole section, is cause and effect.
Ah, which brings us right back to our old friend, David Hume.
Always back to Hume.
Yeah.
As Hume famously pointed out a huge flaw in how we think about the world.
Yeah.
He said we never actually see causation happen.
I mean, if I drop my coffee mug, I see gravity cause it to fall.
Do you? Let's use Hume's classic example of the billiard balls.
Yeah.
You hit the cue ball. You see ball A move across the table.
Right.
You see it physically touch ball B, and then it stops. And then you see ball B move away. You saw a sequence of events. First this, then that. But you never actually saw a physical force connecting them. Causation itself is invisible.
Right. It's just one thing happening after another. Constant conjunction, I think they call it. We just assume the cause is there because we see the sequence happen so often.
Hume said it was just a psychological habit. We just get used to seeing it.
But Kant disagrees with that entirely.
Kant says it is absolutely not just a habit. It's a fundamental rule of human cognition. We are hardwired to think in terms of causes.
It's an a priori category.
Yes. Universal and necessary. You physically cannot look at an event like a window suddenly shattering without your brain instantly demanding what caused that.
It's an operating system requirement. If there's no cause, the program just crashes.
Exactly. And by arguing this, Kant actually saves science from Hume's skepticism. He validates Newtonian physics.
Because he's saying cause and effect aren't just habits, they are guaranteed rules of the system.
Right. He says, yes, Newton's mechanical laws of cause and effect are absolutely true.
But there's a catch, isn't there?
There is always a catch with Kant.
What is it?
They are only true for the world as we experience it. They are only true for the phenomena.
Okay, we need to pause here and define these terms, because the research explicitly states this is the great divide in Kant's philosophy.
It's the most important distinction he makes. Phenomena versus noumena.
Let's start with phenomena.
Phenomena is simply the world as it appears to us. It's the ice cubes.
It's the world after it has been completely filtered through our space, our time, and our categories.
Yes, the world of our experience.
And the noumena.
The noumena is the world as it actually is in itself, independent of any human observation.
The raw water before it hits the tray.
Exactly. The unfiltered, unprocessed reality.
And the million-dollar question, can we ever actually know the noumena?
No.
Like, yeah. Never.
Not the, even with better microscopes or telescopes.
Never, because a microscope is still just feeding visual data into your space-time glasses. You cannot step outside of your own mind.
There is a permanent wall between us and reality. We can think about the noumena, we can speculate about what's out there, but we can never logically or scientifically know the thing in itself.
We are permanently locked inside the simulation our own minds create.
That's the harsh truth of his system.
Which honestly begs a huge question regarding his motivation here. Why did he do this?
What do you mean?
It feels like he just built an incredibly elaborate intellectual prison for humanity. If we can't ever know true reality, what is the point of all this philosophy? Why go to all this trouble just to prove to us that we are effectively blind?
That is the genius of Kant. He wasn't just being difficult or pessimistic. He built that wall to save something far more important to him.
To save what?
Think about the scientific revolution happening during his time. The world was increasingly being viewed as a giant mechanical clockwork.
Newtonian physics was explaining everything.
But if those strict deterministic laws of physics apply to absolutely everything in existence, then everything is determined.
A causes B, which causes C, on and on forever.
Exactly. And if humans are just part of that physical world, then every action you take is just a result of a prior cause.
Meaning, if I decide to lift my arm right now, that wasn't actually a free choice. It was just a chain reaction of biology and chemistry.
Right. We become nothing more than biological robots. In a purely mechanical universe, there is absolutely no room for human freedom. There is no room for morality. And there is no room for God.
So Kant draws this massive line in the sand.
He deliberately restricts the reach of science. He says to science, you have total dominion over the phenomena. You can explain the appearances, you can study the ice cubes all day long.
But you cannot touch the water.
Exactly. He leaves the noumena, the true reality behind the scenes, completely open and untouched by mechanical laws.
He creates a safe space.
He famously wrote, I have found it necessary to deny knowledge in order to make room for faith.
Wow.
By proving that our deterministic science only applies to the simulation in our heads, he protects the human soul. He argues that in the noumenal realm, we might actually be genuinely free.
That is an absolute 4D chess move.
It really is.
He saved the validity of science by severely limiting its jurisdiction.
Precisely.
But here is where things get really messy. And we need to transition to the legacy of all this because the source material has a whole section dedicated to the fallout.
The good, the bad, and the subjective.
Yeah. Because Kant thought he was solving the problem of knowledge once and for all, right?
He did. He assumed that his transcendental method, this process of stripping away the matter to find the hidden form of the mind, was the final word.
He thought every single human being had the exact same ice cube tray.
Exactly. He believed the categories were universal to all rational creatures.
So even if we are all hallucinating the world, we are at least hallucinating the exact same world. Truth is still universal.
That was his earnest hope. But the thinkers who came after him, the Romantics and the German idealists, they looked at his work and they took it in a radically different direction.
They took his ball and ran to a completely different stadium.
They said, okay, Kant, if the mind actively constructs reality, then the human mind is essentially a creative force. It's not just a mirror anymore.
Which, on a personal level, sounds incredibly empowering.
Oh, it's very empowering. It gave birth to the whole Romantic movement, the idea of the passionate, creative self generating a new world.
But there is a dark side to this focus on the creative self.
The evil that men do lives after them.
Right. Because once you establish that reality is subjective, people start asking a very dangerous question.
What if my categories are different from yours?
Exactly. What if my ice cube tray is shaped by my specific language, or my culture, or the time period I was born in?
And the moment you introduce that idea, truth isn't universal anymore.
It becomes completely relative.
This is the slippery slope the source warns about. You go from Kant's idea of a universal human structure to a group structure.
And the research points out that we have to be careful when we talk about this political legacy. We are just tracing the historical path outlined in the text here without taking any sides.
Of course. Impartially speaking, the historical transition went from Kant's individual subjectivity to corporate identity.
And that corporate identity fueled the rise of German nationalism in the 19th and 20th centuries.
Because if reality is shaped by the mind, and you start to believe that different cultures or nations have distinct spirits, or what they call the Volk,
then you start arguing that the German reality is fundamentally, biologically, or culturally different from the French reality.
And truth ceases to be an objective fact about the world, and instead becomes a property of the nation, or the race.
Which obviously led to historically catastrophic consequences.
It's incredibly dangerous. It shifts the entire philosophical focus from discovering objective truth to asserting subjective identity.
And if you keep pushing that exact same snowball further down the hill into the modern era, the text argues you eventually arrive at postmodernism.
Yes. The philosophical stance where there is no overarching objective truth whatsoever.
Only competing narratives. My truth versus your truth.
Kant would have been absolutely horrified by that outcome.
Because his entire goal was to secure objective science, not destroy it.
Exactly. But by locating the foundational structure of reality inside the human subject, he unintentionally left the back door open for total relativism.
It's almost like he handed humanity a mirror so we could finally see ourselves, and we got so utterly obsessed with our own reflection that we forgot the outside world even existed.
That is a brilliant way to phrase it.
Yeah.
But to be fair to Kant, we shouldn't only focus on the negative political legacy.
Right. There were incredibly positive developments, too.
The source specifically mentions depth psychology. Thinkers like Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung owe a massive direct debt to Immanuel Kant.
How does Kant connect to psychoanalysis?
Think about the core premise of Kant's work, the idea that there are hidden, unconscious structures operating under the hood. These structures filter and shape our experience and our behavior long before we are consciously aware of them.
That is pure Kant, just applied to emotions instead of geometry.
Exactly. Whether you are talking about space and time categories or Oedipus complexes and archetypes, the fundamental lesson is the same.
We are never seeing the raw, unedited feed of our own minds. We are always reacting to the edited cut.
We are the directors of our own reality. We are actively taking the raw dough of the universe and shaping it with the cookie cutters of our mind.
Before we wrap up, we should probably clarify one last nuance the source text emphasized regarding that word, subjective.
Oh, right. Objective versus subjective, because those terms get thrown around loosely.
Yeah, the text notes that objective can mean two things. It can mean something that exists independently of the mind.
Like a physical rock.
Or it can refer to a detached, unemotional attitude, like a professor grading a math test objectively.
And similarly, subjective can mean something that only exists inside the mind, like a dream or Kant's categories.
Or it can mean a state of passionate personal involvement.
Like Kierkegaard's view of religious faith, truth is subjectivity.
It's an important distinction to keep in mind when navigating all this philosophy. So as we close out this deep dive, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final provocation drawn from today's research.
It's a question that really lingers.
Because if we really, truly take Kant seriously, it leads to a very strange place. If space, if time, if the very concept of cause and effect are just the internal software of the human mind,
then what does the universe actually look like without us?
If you take away the observer, you take away the here, you take away the now.
You erase before and after. You erase causation entirely.
Is the universe just a timeless, spaceless, static something?
We literally cannot conceive of it. The moment you try to picture it, you're using space and time to do it.
Yeah.
We constantly run headfirst into the walls of our own minds.
It makes you wonder, does the fact that we completely construct our own meaningful world make that world somehow less real? Or does it actually make our existence far more profound?
I lean toward profound. It means the order and the beauty we see in the cosmos isn't just something we stumbled upon. It's something we actively generated.
I think I am definitely going to need a few minutes, and maybe that drink we talked about in the intro, to fully process all of that. Next time you hear a simple rhythm, a clap, 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 just ask yourself, who is actually keeping the beat? Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive.
See you in the next reality.